Don't spend another winter with your home colder than it should be. Hi, I'm Roy Spencer with PermaSeal. We measure the amount of heat loss and recommend solutions to keep it comfortable. Call PermaSeal for your free estimate, 800-421-SEAL, or visit permaseal.net.
WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. We are playing that song, that very festive song, here on the Wintrust Business Lunch because the artist behind that song is huge on Snapchat, and we're going to be talking about Snapchat because he is, I would say, subverting it just a tiny bit. But Snapchat is one of those platforms that people, it's very polarizing. People either love it or hate it. So we're going to be talking about that here in just a little bit. But later in the show, we're going to be talking about nonprofits and how they thrived during the recession when so many for-profits were really, really struggling to make ends meet. And we're going to be talking about this trend of the micro apartments, those tiny little houses that people are kind of crazy for. And there's lots of TV shows popping up about them. And there's all this stuff. But how practical are they really? And who's really doing it? So we're going to take a look at those numbers and tons more. Plenty of stuff to get into, and we're going to be checking in with our good friend Bob Kessler up in the newsroom for news traffic and weather throughout the hour. Okay, so Snapchat, as I was saying. There is a story in Bloomberg, and it is really, really interesting, and it's kind of about, it's a bit about the business model of Snapchat, but it's about how it's thriving because it is relatively inaccessible, which I find very, very funny. So joining us now is Max Chafkin, who is a writer at Bloomberg and co-wrote this piece. Hi, Max. How are you?
How's it going? Thanks for having me.
Glad you could make it. Thank you so much for joining us. So talk to us about Snapchat, because it really is one of those that even people that I know that are very open to new technologies and new platforms and just kind of embrace the new and are very open to them, even those folks are kind of struggling with Snapchat. And it does seem that there is a bit of a generational gap.
For sure. And I think it's probably helpful to just give a little history here. So Snapchat sort of came on the scene about 3 years ago, and it was primarily known kind of as a sexting app because it was a way to send messages between friends, and the messages disappeared as soon as they were posted. And, kids in high school are using this all sorts of ways, but of course, a disappearing message is good for,
for body parts, right?
Inappropriate content. Right. But the thing that's happened, and this is what's so surprising, is that Snapchat has kind of morphed into something that looks maybe a threat to Facebook and also, some kind of a threat to other kinds of traditional media. Basically, what's happened, this is your Snapchat profile, as it were. It's called your story. It consists of 10-second videos that, you upload to Snapchat that your friends can see, and they disappear at the end of the day. So what it basically means is that there's nothing permanent about it, and teenagers especially feel it's a safer place than Facebook. One of the things that's happened is Facebook has morphed from being, kind of what Snapchat was a few years ago, a dangerous place, into a place where, you might use it to talk to your boss or your teacher or your children's soccer coach, and Barack Obama's on Facebook. It's not a place where you'd want to just post a funny joke or just goof off with your friends, and that's kind of what Snapchat's become. At the same time, they've made rather smart deals with a bunch of big media companies, and as a result, you have like basically the news for kids. You have a bunch of CNN, Vice, BuzzFeed have sort of channels within Snapchat that millennials in particular are consuming in big numbers. So you have what kind of is starting to look like a really serious media company birthed out of this sexting app.
Right. And I think it took a little time to shake that reputation as this kind of lewd, hangout. And it was all about sexting and that kind of thing. But I think what was very interesting to me was over the summer when Hearst Media Group released Sweet. There's a publication that's only available on Snapchat. That seemed like a kind of a bit of a there have been a few turning points, but I think that was certainly one of them where people kind of said, okay,
for
this
sure.
is really, we have to look at this in a different way. And when I started to see a lot lot of marketers really start taking Snapchat a lot more seriously, because it seemed like the way they were kind of doubling down within that discovery area with the brands.
Yes, that's correct. So Hearst has a standalone Snapchat magazine called Sweet, as you said. Also, a lot of the sort of publications on Snapchat have real staffs. People's Snapchat Discover channel, which, you know, puts out, I don't know, probably about 5 to 10 minutes worth of content a day. It's sort of like a very short TV show or something. Mm-hmm. That's 10 people working on that every single day. And some of the staffs of these little sort of Snapchat magazines are even bigger. Being included in just being allowed to make one of these things is seen as a real prize within the media world. Like, there's only 20 of them right now, and I'd guess there's probably at least another 20 publishers, probably more, who'd be dying mm-hmm. to be included because the numbers are so big. We're talking about 100 million people each day logging onto Snapchat, which doesn't seem like that much if you have been paying attention to the news with respect to Facebook, which has more than a billion people a day. But Snapchat's demographics are really good. 86% of the people using it are under 35, and a high number are in the U.S. So we're talking about a number that, like, you know, is just making marketers salivate.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. But, you know, the thing that I think a lot of people hang on is that it's really, despite all that, it's relatively not user-friendly.
Right. Which is kind of a funny, there's a paradox there. It's sort of hard to figure out, did they do this on purpose? Because the thing is, one of the results of being user-unfriendly is it sort of kept out forgive me for saying this, the olds.
Right.
People who are not necessarily in demographics that marketers are really excited about. And so it looks almost like a really savvy decision to make this thing kind of hard to penetrate. And I do think it's worth, you know, playing around with, even if you are a little afraid of it, just because it's, first of all, it's kind of fun, and as we you alluded to DJ Khaled at the beginning, I mean, there's stuff that's in there that is, you know, entertaining and different and new, and I would predict we quote somebody in the story saying this that many many more people who right now are thinking, oh my God, no way am I going to do Snapchat, are going to be signing up within the next, you know, year and a half or so.
Mm-hmm. I think DJ Khaled is one of the first examples that I can really, really remember of when I started to see Snapchat content shared outside of Snapchat.
Right. So I should probably just explain who he is for a second. He's a hip hop impresario. He has put out these, they're sort of like compilation albums, but starting late last year, he just kind of on a whim started doing these kind of little self-help videos. And they're really hard to explain, and they won't seem funny if I say them, but basically telling people that it's important to eat breakfast and work out and everything. But they're done in this sort of really deadpan and hilarious way that makes them really compelling. And he has something like 6 million followers on Snapchat. And what's really amazing is that each one of his videos, these little 10-second things where he's, you know, taking a picture of him watering his plants or eating breakfast or what have you, are getting something like 3 million viewers. And so, you know, that's a real audience,
right,
for something that seems almost trivial. And it kind of gives you a sense of just how weird the platform is, but also how many people find it compelling.
Definitely. I mean, that's I think a good explanation, because it has a hang in there, kitty kind of a vibe to it, the way he approaches. And they're all kind of funny. I mean, there's one of him on a jet ski and him just kind of doing ridiculous stuff that's all very funny. And so, you know, we're talking about like a $16 billion operation for Snapchat. And it's really, you know, I think because of this idea of it being a sexting platform, because of the young user base, I think it gets, you know, it gets written off and under appreciated, really, even though it is really just such marketing gold. Is the business model, because it is a bit murky, is it primarily through that Discover feature where the revenue is?
So the important thing to know here is the business is very early. I mean, they weren't really, they were doing almost nothing about a year ago. The main way they make money is selling advertisements inside of Discover, which is the media the media partnership thing. So inside of CNN Snapchat channel, for instance, you can see 10-second ads from major advertisers. Snapchat also creates their own content, and they have a team of about 100 people, including some journalists and photographers and producers who are basically, you know, covering the news. One of the things that actually has been sort of pretty impressive is has been their politics coverage. They've been in the, you know, in Iowa and New Hampshire, kind of giving you almost a visceral sense of what it's like. And there are ads inside of those things too, and those ads are also, you know, pretty lucrative. What we thought as we dug into the company, we think they've got about $200 million in revenue, which is pretty small. But considering that they haven't pushed the advertising business that hard, we think that, you know, there's a lot of potential, and that's why they just raised another big chunk of capital at the same $16 billion valuation. So it's promising, but it's very early.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting to watch that, especially as you point out, an election year. I have been very interested in the political efforts going on with Snapchat. All right, Max Chafkin, thanks so much for being with us. Go find this story. It's at Bloomberg, How Snapchat Built a Business by Confusing Olds. Check it out over there. Thanks for being with us today, Max.
Thanks for having me.
All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, we are talking all about nonprofits that survived and thrived during the recession when for-profits were not necessarily doing the same. All right, we'll be back in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us. This chilly and overcast Saturday, we'll be checking in with our good friend Bob Kessler up in the newsroom for news, traffic, and weather throughout the hour. He'll be telling us about the latest with weather and what we can expect in the week ahead. I think maybe we've got good news? Question mark? Here's hoping anyway. All right, my friends, next up on the Business Lunch, we are talking all about the industry that added jobs during the recession when so many other industries were doing quite the opposite. Joining us is Lydia DePillis from Washington Post. Hi, Lydia. How are you?
Hi, Amy. I'm well.
Thanks so much for joining us today. Well, so you wrote this story that's on WashingtonPost.com. Everyone, go check this story out. It's really, really interesting, and you have some really great data and some really wonderful graphics in this story. But talk us through this a bit, because it seems that you were tracking how nonprofits really were thriving in the recession at a time when so many for-profits were doing quite the opposite.
Sure, and I found this surprising because we actually did hear a lot about donations to nonprofits declining. And so I wondered, when this data came out from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, how could it be that, in fact, employment in the sector rose all the way through from, 2007 till the latest data, which is 2012. And during that time, as I'm sure your listeners are familiar, the private sector shed millions of jobs. Mm-hmm. So it struck me as a puzzle. And so what we found when I asked a woman who specializes in nonprofit administration at the Urban Institute, what she explained is that even though donations from private sources had declined, the federal government stepped up in a big way through the stimulus, which made up especially for a lot of the decline in state and local dollars. And at the same time, nonprofits, which had kept a little bit of money in reserve, were able to deploy that to keep their staffing healthy, and perhaps some folks were willing to take a little bit less in salary in order to stay on. And so what you had was a bunch of service providers who were really needed at that point to do things like provide healthcare and education training programs for people who'd lost their jobs, were able to step in and serve those needs as they were mounting quickly.
Definitely. And it is very interesting because it is a bit counterintuitive, but it makes perfect sense when you lay it out. In the story that you wrote on WashingtonPost.com, you make note of emergency staff. So are we going to see staffing, it seems like they're perhaps shedding staff now in the way that we saw for-profit the for-profit sector shedding staff during the thick of the recession. Is that what we probably will be seeing on the horizon with the nonprofits?
That's what the Urban Institute woman, Shenna Ashley, did expect. And it's both because nonprofits have exhausted some of the reserves that they expended during the recession, and also some of the needs have declined a bit. There isn't the kind of mass unemployment that tends to require services. People, you know, can pay for their own groceries a little bit more often, and or might not have to rely on emergency health care quite as often. And she said we shouldn't be too concerned about the nonprofit sector contracting. In fact, when the rest of the economy is starting to look a little healthier.
Right. You know, every time we speak with somebody behind a nonprofit here in the show, usually there's a theme of, hey, if we're succeeding, eventually we'll go away. Eventually people won't need us.
Yeah.
So I think there is a bit of a different mindset there.
It's hard to embrace that recognition, especially if you like having a job and want to perpetuate and justify your existence. But mature nonprofits, I think, sometimes, you know, have made their peace with that.
Right. It does take a very self-actualized person to be able to think about it that way, that if you do your job well, it will, in fact, go away. And I think that's certainly the opposite of the way most of us think about employment. But indeed, it is a different beast in the nonprofit sector. All right. Well, everybody, please go to WashingtonPost.com. This story is by Lydia DePillis, who wrote this. All this great story around all this great data that came out with from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. I encourage you to go there. Check out all the information she's got there. Thank you so much for being with us today, Lydia.
No problem.
All right. My friends, we are going to check in with Bob Kessler up in the newsroom and get to break and all that good stuff. And when we come back, we're talking about this trend of micro houses and tiny, tiny micro apartments and what that means here in Chicago. We'll be right back on the Wintrust Business Lunch here in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks so much for being with us today. A little bit later in the show, we're going to talk about a scandal in a very unlikely place. Stick around for that. But right now, we have got to discuss this trend of micro housing. You know, the shows on TV with the tiny little houses and the micro apartments and all that good stuff. We got to talk about that because it is a thing. Lots of people are on board? Maybe. We shall see. Joining us right now is Liz Greenspan from The New Yorker. Welcome to the show, Liz.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Well, so talk us through this trend, because it seems like a lot of people are talking about it, but I've yet to meet anyone who's actually done it. So is it kind of all hype right now? Are people really making the shift to this smaller housing?
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends on, you know, where you are, but there definitely are people who are jumping on board. In cities, it's the micro apartment, and so it's a lot of younger people who want to live downtown, and they see this as it's a little more affordable sometimes, although not always. And it gives them, they don't have a lot of stuff yet, and they don't want a lot of stuff necessarily, and so they can get a small space, you know, before they move on to their next city and you know, live there. And then the tiny house movement is a little bit different, I think, because it's people who often want to kind of unplug, you know, they want to get away from it a little bit, and they want to be, it's often a little more remote, but it's similar in that it's about really, you know, simplifying and living in these well-designed small spaces.
Definitely. And that is an important distinction to make, I think. You know, in the case of the micro apartments, is it really about people embracing minimalism, or is it really about wanting to get, you know, access to luxurious living, you know, a luxurious apartment, and the trade-off is space? Or is it a little bit of both?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think it's partly who you ask. When I look at it, I think you're right. I think people, it's less about the minimalism, because it often goes hand in hand with living in an expensive city where you're spending a lot of money just to be there, just to go out. And what you give up in space, you often give up in the kitchen size. You know, you're not cooking all your meals at home. You're like out in the city, and that's, you know, you're spending. And so it's a different kind, maybe it's a different kind of consumption. You know, you don't have a lot of things that you own, but you still, you know, it's not minimalistic in like the sense of your lifestyle, you know, being saving and that kind of thing.
Right.
So I think there is a sense of luxury that goes on, and a lot of the, you know, small apartments now, and in the piece that I wrote about, they do have a lot of high-end finishes and, you know, stainless steel appliances, and so they're giving, there's a certain look that a lot of these apartments have too.
Certainly, and it's kind of, you know, I think it's easily connected to the conversation about the affordable housing crisis, but it's hard to kind of connect those dots when we're talking about, yes, it's a, you know, 400 square foot apartment, but it has a butler.
Right. Exactly. I mean, I think that's one of the big questions is like, oh, a lot of people talk about micro apartments and affordable housing in the same sentence. And yet at the same time, the apartments that they're talking about still have pretty costly rents. Like, they're not cheaper because they're smaller. And the reason they're not cheaper is because a lot of these extras have been built in, like, you know, these apps that will deliver your groceries and pick up your dry cleaning, and they have, you know, Wi-Fi, and then there are a lot of amenities like built gyms and like lounges that are in the building to kind of make up for this fact that it's smaller. So yes, you have less space, but then they're kind of building all of this other stuff in that enable the developers to charge more for the rent. And so, so yeah, it's not affordable. I mean, I think that's one of the big misconceptions is that it seems like it could be. I mean, there's a logic there. If it's less space, it should be cheaper. But by and large, especially in cities like New York and D.C., Chicago, you know, for the most part, the rents are still competitive with what a studio, but a larger studio would be.
Right, definitely. And I think that's very interesting how you point out the consumer angle, because while it might be about less physical stuff, there are these other pieces of consumerism, you know, with an app to deliver your groceries or a butler, or, you know, very high-end kitchens that you may or may not be using because the place is so small. I think that's a very interesting point, you know, because I think that we do get a little bit sideways with this topic, and it gets, I think, two directions I've seen it go in that after reading your piece in The New Yorker, it seems like it's kind of, you know, set both of them aside, really, because one of them kind of is about the Marie Kondo stuff and, you know, the magic of tidying up, and everyone's so nuts for that book and this minimalism conversation. The other one is this affordable housing conversation. It seems like this really is neither. This is really a very, very different thing. And this is about more people are staying single for longer periods of time and kind of thinking, do I really need all this space if it's just me?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. A lot of it, and the way the cities are framing it too, in part, is to take care of this growing population of single people. You know, people, like you said, they're coming in, they want to live in the city in the first place. So there's this move into the city, and then they're staying single longer, and they don't necessarily know where they'll be, so they don't feel like owning property is not necessarily as important as it once was. So that's the push behind it. I think the fact that there is this, like you said, this simplifying and simplicity is being valued right now in the sense of minimalism, it helps make it all trendy. It helps make it feel cool, and it helps marketers, you know, pitch it to a certain demographic. But it isn't really, it's a little bit of a bait and switch, because it isn't actually like, you know, getting back to the roots and kind of clearing away all of the stuff that we've been accumulating over the years. There is, like you said, a lot of money and a lot of, like, when you have people running around running your errands for you, you know, you don't have to do it, but someone else is doing it for you. So that sense of less isn't, you know, it's not actually less.
Right. I think, too, you point out in the story that you can find at newyorker.com about how it sort of seemed like it challenged a few laws, particularly in New York, about what the minimum size of an apartment unit could be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, that was one of the things that made this project, this first complex of micro apartments in New York, controversial, was because until now, for the past 25 years or so, there's been a law that said you couldn't have an apartment, or you couldn't build a new apartment that was smaller than 400 square feet. So there are apartments in the city that have been, because they, you know, were built prior to that date in the 80s, but since then, no new development is smaller than 400 square feet. And, you know, that law has a long history, and trying to kind of find a way to make sure that there's a standard amount of space that everyone has, and that's seen as a kind of livable, humane amount of space that everyone should be guaranteed, whether you're rich or poor, you know, coming into the city. Now they're saying this complex, this micro apartment complex that they built, is part of an effort to get rid of that law. And in fact, there are new zoning regulations in New York that they're considering and will be voting on soon that get rid of it. And so now there'll be more freedom to build these smaller places for singles. You know, that's the case the city is making. And I think different cities have different regulations. And so it's a kind of, I know you can look at different municipalities across the country, and they all have slightly different rules, you know, slightly different amounts of spaces that have been regulated, slightly different density kind of regulations, you know, that would allow for a certain number of small units in a building. And there isn't yet, I think, a standard or a norm that's been established, because this is kind of new. So different cities are trying out different things. The danger, though, is that it could, if that, you know, it's unregulated. And so, you know, one of the things that I think was important, you know, when I was talking to the architects of this complex in New York, they were saying how important it is that the space have high ceilings, for example, and have a large window, and that helps make it feel less claustrophobic, given that the square footage is smaller. And so, and he was saying too that he thinks, though, if this becomes more common, that he would hope that they would find a way to build regulations in that could ensure certain standards along those lines. Because you could imagine a smaller space, that they start to shrink the ceilings down, or, you know, try to fit more of them in, and that could be a bad move for residents.
Oh, certainly. I think anytime we see a regulation kind of lifted or tweaked, there's always someone who's going to abuse that.
You know,
and certainly having lived in several tiny New York City apartments myself, I know exactly what the potential there is for doom. So, well, thank you so much for joining us today. We're a bit out of time, but everybody go to newyorker.com and read the story, "Are Micro Apartments a Good Solution to the Affordable Housing Crisis?" It is by Liz Greenspan. Thanks so much for joining us today, Liz.
Thank you. Thanks. My pleasure.
All right. My friends, we'll be back in just a bit here on the Wintrust Business Lunch, and we're going to be talking about an interesting scandal in a very unexpected place here on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. My friends, when we think about scandals, we think about politics, we think about celebrities, maybe even the sports world. But one place where we do not think about scandal is the crossword puzzle world. But indeed, here we are. There is a fascinating story on 538.com that is all about this scandal that is kind of erupted in the crossword puzzle world. Of all places, it seems so civilized there. And yet there are accusations of plagiarism and false identity and all the good elements of a good drama. And so that's a thing happening. So I recommend go to 538 and read the story. It is super interesting. But esteemed producer Griffin Filipich found this story, and you started telling me about this, and it's a weird story, because it seems like every time every paragraph has this completely bizarre new layer to it, because you don't expect scandal in the crossword realm.
I don't even think about, I never think about the people who even make them. So not only do I not think about scandal, but I just don't think about anybody. I should more.
I kind of do, because I curse them when I can't figure it out.
Well, you also have a little more insight to the newspaper business. And I was wondering how you felt about this story, considering that. But yeah, no, I definitely don't expect scandal from there. But I rarely even think about the people behind the puzzles. So this story gave me a window into a whole world and a whole disruption of a world I didn't even think about existing.
It's a subset, certainly, of any newsroom. And most most news organizations will rely on a syndicated crossword puzzle. You rarely will have a person in there doing the puzzle. But I have thought often about that, having worked in many aspects of a newsroom myself. I've thought often about the crossword puzzle, because it seems like a copy editing nightmare and a fact-checking nightmare, because you've got to, you know, several people need to work that puzzle. One time, though, I had a very interesting request that I was really happy to honor, and that was somebody called me up and wanted to, his girlfriend was a huge fan of the crossword puzzle, And he wanted to take out an ad in the paper, and in the ad space, he wanted to create a crossword puzzle in which he would propose marriage to her. And I thought that was a lovely romantic gesture, and I was all in favor of it. Got him squared away with some salespeople, and he paid for the ad space, and it was all good. And then the crossword puzzle comes through. And I said, well, I need to, you know, because I got to see it way in advance. If I put an inaccurate crossword puzzle in the paper, I will never hear the end of it, right? People are very passionate about their crossword puzzles. And if they think they're getting a bonus one and they work and it's not going to work, it's going to be bad. There'll be hell to pay. So I get this crossword puzzle and I start working it and I can't do it. I'm stuck on two of these things. Turns out there were, in fact, errors in them. He had spelled, I think, the word czar incorrectly, which is common. Like, there's scandal around the way to spell czar, but he had spelled czar incorrectly. And I don't remember the other word, but if you solved those two clues accurately, it would, in fact, completely mess up the proposal part. It would make her name wrong. Which is not at all what you want to do if you're proposing to a woman. Do not mess up her name, of all things. Do not.
Because when it appears in a crossword, that's legal. That's legally binding now. And you have to marry the person that you...
You can't say no.
Whatever name you spelled out.
Well, I checked with him and I was like, gosh, I really hope she said yes, because that's... You went to great lengths. But she did. She did. The thing he told me, though, was that she, that particular day, was quite busy and didn't get around to the crossword puzzle on the train on the way into work, as she normally did. And so he was... waiting all morning, thinking she would call him and say, yes, of course, I'll marry you. And the call never came. And he was kind of like, well, guess that's a no. So he finally called her just to say hi at lunchtime or something. Mm. And, hey, did you do a crossword puzzle this morning? No, I was so stressed out about this report. I did that on the train. So I think it could, I think if memory serves, and this was a few years ago, but if memory serves, I believe he ended up a couple of days later going, hey, let's do the crossword puzzle. I saved it for you.
A couple days later?
Yeah. So that guy was probably extremely stressed out during that time.
That's not great. Yeah. I don't know what the way around that is. Like, you should really do the crossword
puzzle. No, seriously. Do the crossword
Please.
Puzzle now.
I'm telling you.
And I think he said he sat down and did it with her. Like, let's do this. I know you love this. This is great. Which I'm sure tipped her off. Something's weird. Either
And then you find, like, little ways to annoy each other when you're doing a group activity like that.
And then you break up. It's done.
She thinks that it's one answer and he thinks it's another, and that's like a little tiff then.
Lots of like, you always second guess. You never trust my insight in the crossword. I know crossword puzzles, and they bicker and they fight and they break up.
Very unsavory. Well, that's another crossword scandal, if I dare. We're really throwing this word around now. But let me just read the first paragraph of this story. It says, since 1999, Timothy Parker, editor of one of the nation's most widely syndicated crosswords, has edited more than 60 individual puzzles that copy elements from New York Times puzzles.
Scandal A.
Often with pseudonyms for bylines.
Scandal B.
A new database has helped reveal. The puzzles in question repeated themes, answers, grids, and clues from Times puzzles published years earlier. Hundreds more of the puzzles edited by Parker are nearly verbatim copies of previous puzzles that Parker also edited. Which is a little confusing, but he's kind of plagiarizing himself in addition to the New York Times. Most of these have been republished under fake author names. And yeah, he's the you mentioned that most of these are syndicated, and he is the editor of USA Today and also a Universal UClick, which does a syndicated...
widely distributed crossword
puzzles.
Yeah,
widely distributed, so both.
If you are into crossword puzzles, you have definitely worked one by one of those two.
Yeah, and it's worth noting that he outright denies plagiarism and says that it's going to happen every once in a while.
Which is, you know what, I think a relatively valid argument, because there's only so many, you know, we all see, if you've done more than 10 crossword puzzles in your life, you're going to see the same things kind of pop up, right?
Right.
There's just some words that are full of vowels that are really useful that get used a lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, lots of, you know, there's lots of names I feel like that show up in all... I have long had that as a goal personally, that if your name is in a crossword puzzle, you have made it in life.
Yeah, yeah.
I've yet to achieve that goal at all. But, you know, Guth, it'll fit. It's four letters. G-U-T-H. Boom, 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 boom. It'd be super easy.
You should have done that when the guy was proposing. Like,
right. I will let you do this, sir, if you work my name in as a crossword clue.
Yeah. You missed opportunity. But yeah, but that all sounds well and good. But when you get down to the graphs and they show how often other puzzles accidentally plagiarize or like happen to use the same clues in the same kind of structure, it does happen occasionally, but very occasionally. And the instances are like astronomically higher for this one guy.
Oh, yeah.
So it does seem a little fishy. And then they show specific examples. Here's one. On January 8th, 2001, New York Times published a puzzle with three long theme answers: drive up the wall, get on one's nerves, and rub the wrong way. So they're all clues containing the word exasperate.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the theme for that puzzle. And in an...
so that was January 2001.
Yeah, and in 2010, he published one that used those three terms in the exact same spaces on the puzzle. And it's like, I don't think that that can possibly be a coincidence, right?
No. And, right, I get it how the puzzles have themes around them. You know, they're all variations of the word exasperate. Or they'll spell something out. Sometimes it'll spell out, like, the first line of the Star-Spangled Banner or something like that, right?
Yeah.
I get that, that maybe there are only so many themes in the world that you will have to recycle them. But, indeed, if you look at the – if you go to 538.com and look at the story, they have this graphic on there. It is the exact same spot.
Yeah. I was much more skeptical in the first few paragraphs. I was kind of on this guy's side. He's saying things like, you know, I've been doing – you'd put out so many puzzles.
Yeah.
I spend so much time doing this. Everybody's doing it, so it's bound to happen. But as you go on, it looks a little more crossword scandalous, which is not something I considered possible.
Hashtag things I never thought I would discuss on the radio. But I think it's really interesting how this was all discovered, because the idea of a database cross-checking all these is super interesting. And you think about, I never want to be one to say, don't worry about X because there's more important things to worry about. But in this case, it seems like that's a very specific, very specific use of an algorithm.
Yeah.
And I have to assume it was put in place because there had to be, I mean, you wouldn't build that if you did not suspect there was some repetition going on.
Well, that's actually the interesting thing. And I can't remember this guy's name, but go to the story and you'll find it. But he says he put this database together not to look for plagiarism, because he was interested in the art of crossword building and just wanted to look for certain patterns that arise. But he wasn't looking
for... So he was open to what the data would say.
Right, yeah. He was just looking for patterns in the way these crossword writers use words and, you know, looking to help himself kind of figure it out. But what he uncovered is this kind of bizarre...
So he went in looking for, like, the crossword
plagiarism.
Equivalent of card counting to game the crossword system.
I guess that's one way of looking
at it. And he's emerged this, whistleblower of the crossword world. It is really interesting. I mean, it seems kind of ridiculous, really, when you think, oh, it's a crossword puzzle. What's the big deal? But in fact, it is.
It is work.
It is, I mean.
Time and work and, yeah, hard
people
work.
People are, it's not an easy thing to do. It's certainly not like sitting down writing an article. It is a big deal to write under a different name in the journalism world, because all you have is your byline and the reputation and credibility attached to it, really. So this will certainly alter that for him. And we're talking about a lot of revenue. News organizations pay a lot to have crossword puzzles in their printed editions and online as well. And a lot of people have built a lot of different web tools so that people can work crossword puzzles online as we move to getting our news more and more so online. So indeed, there is a scandal afoot in the crossword puzzle world. That's a great find, Griffin. I love it.
Stay tuned for more.
That's right. More scandals and all that good stuff here on 720 WGN.